From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Richard Luchendress, Washington correspondent for TV8 Nouvelle. Our moderator is Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and USA Today.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. The nasty battle over President Trump's choice for the Supreme Court heads into its final stages. A blockbuster news report accuses President Trump, when he was younger, of being involved, among other things, in tax fraud. The United States and Canada reach an agreement on trade. We'll go in depth. And the U.S., the U.N., and sanctions on Iran. Well, let's start first with this Supreme Court case. Our global listeners might not know that the U.S. government has three separate but equal parts. There's the executive branch, that's the president, there's the Congress, and there's the Supreme Court. Now, for someone to be appointed to the Supreme Court, he or she has to be nominated by the president, and then they have to be approved by the upper chamber of the legislature. That's the Senate. That's where we are now. A judge, his name is Brett Kavanaugh, was nominated 2 months ago, and the fight to win approval has been exceptionally nasty. And as of this conversation, it's unclear whether he will be approved or not. Richard, let's begin with you. Bring our listeners up to speed on sort of what's going on and where things stand.
Okay, the hearings went smoothly for Judge Kavanaugh, who has an impressive record, conservative, but very impressive record. And then came allegations of sexual misconduct, allegations of unacceptable behavior while he was in high school and in college. And then new hearings happened last week. Let's just jump to last week when we heard him and one of the women accusing him of sexual misconduct, Christine Blasey Ford. And it was shocking to see the whole thing, which brings us to this week, because she was considered during her testimony as a very credible witness. And he came out very intense, aggressive. We've reached a point where he's been able to convince, it sounds, the Republican senators to support him, and the ones on the other side, the Democrats who didn't like him even less.
So Richard was saying, Tracy, that this, as expected, has pretty much gone down among partisan lines, investigation notwithstanding. I suppose going forward, the question is politically how this is going to play out, whether he's confirmed or not confirmed. The issue to me, it seems, and you tell me, a lot of women all across this country are livid about the way that this principal accuser, Professor Ford, has been treated. On the other hand, a lot of men, perhaps older white men, not to generalize, they are unhappy about the way Kavanaugh has been treated. That's what they say. How does all this play out in your view?
And, you know, initially we were thinking this will galvanize a lot of women voters, Democratic voters and such. And I think that's still the case. But now we've seen kind of the backlash that, as you said, white male voters, many who are Republican, may be galvanized in the upcoming midterm elections. And those are very crucial elections in terms of whether the Republicans retain the two chambers of the legislature. But I think that, as you were describing the three branches of government, the Supreme Court is supposed to be above the political fray. And that has not proven to be the case, certainly, in this debate. And so I think we're going to see a more polarized Supreme Court and, you know, continuing a more and more polarized country.
You know, the way that I see this is that Republicans seem to have made, and either of you can weigh in on this, Republicans seem to have made some kind of a trade-off here, that they understand that if Kavanaugh is approved, it may galvanize more women to go to the polls who were already inclined to vote against the president, vote against Republicans in November. But the trade-off is, okay, we might lose the November election, but there's another election always right around the corner. Meantime, we've got this young guy on the Supreme Court, perhaps for decades to come. That appears to be the trade-off that at least some of them are considering. Is that a reasonable proposition?
I believe so. And so it's the long-term game that they will win if they succeed to have Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. But even the shorter one, Paul, we had a poll this week from Maris for NPR and PBS, and it showed that the gap in enthusiasm of the electorate on the right has climbed. I mean, we felt during springtime that the Democratic voters were enthusiastic and they were, you know, like lining up already at the polls. And now the gap between the two now is in the margin of error. So they have succeeded. And I think maybe the Democrats have to question themselves at a certain point. It's a nail that's easy to hit, the Kavanaugh nail. But at a certain point, it brings back to a certain portion of the electorate the feeling that they're targeting a man who has an impeccable career and go back so many years. I mean, you can argue, it's not to defend him, but you can easily see, and we see this during Trump's rallies during the last week, we've seen it. You can easily portray Kavanaugh as a victim and not sound like you're not respecting the women's feeling of not being listened to. What do you think, Lisa? I agree.
I think that they've calculated the long-term gamble is worth alienating more women who weren't going to vote for them anyway. You know, because initially, you remember, Trump came out fairly moderate in his comments on this whole issue. And then suddenly, he just came out and started attacking Ford in very crude and angry ways. And I think that he had made the calculation. You know, at one point, he complained that his supporters, his base, he was worried they were getting complacent. And so he decided to seize on, you know, his typical very angry, crude rhetoric to fire them up. And, you know, if you lose more women voters, so be it. So I think, as you say, getting Kavanaugh, getting a conservative who, by the way, believes in strong executive power, and I'm sure they're not losing sight of that in the White House, having him on the Supreme Court is worth, you know, losing some women voters.
I suppose the question is, what is the greater number? The number of really angry female voters or the number of older white male voters, that we'll find out, I suppose, in about a month. But beyond, it's not just the 2018 election, but you got to wonder if this anger on both sides will exist come 2020, when the president presumably runs for re-election. Of course, the way things are now, there could be 100 issues between now and then to get people riled up, I suppose. Well, moving on, there was a blockbuster report in the New York Times, which arguably is the most influential newspaper in the country, along with your Los Angeles Times, of course. And it came out with a blockbuster report this week, alleging this report more than a year in the making, three reporters going over about 100,000 pages worth of documents. And the gist of it is they accused President Trump, and they used this language deliberately, apparently, when he was younger, of fraud relating to getting millions of dollars from his late father, real estate company. It's a huge report. Tracy, boil it down for our listeners, if you could.
It's a remarkable report. And as you said, three reporters, more than a year, going over tons of documents. Basically, what they describe is a pattern of deception and dodges, tax dodges, as ways to accumulate millions, hide them from the IRS, avoid paying taxes, and then transferring that money to Donald Trump for him to then begin his empire. And an important element out of all of this is that it sort of destroys the myth that President Trump, both, you know, before he even ran for president, throughout most of his career, had used, which was that he was a self-made billionaire. He got $1 million from his dad, a small loan that he had to pay back, but then all of the rest of the billions he made on his own. And that, if the report is true, and I think it's quite well documented, is not the case.
I don't think everybody actually believed that.
He's sure been running on it. Right. But now they've demonstrated that he was getting a lot more money from his father from the time he was 3 years old. So I think that's important. And then there's just a lot of legal questions about how much of this was, you know, blatant fraud, illegal, how much of it was, you know, dicey. And they've already got the New York Tax Board looking into this for possible illegal action.
You know, Richard, to me, the fact that the Times, they deliberately used the word fraud, suggesting that they are really sure of what they found here. Now, the White House has denied all this. They said, it's just nothing to worry about. This is all done legally, this and that. What happens next?
Well, we'll see what the inquiry will give us. I wouldn't dare try to imagine what will be the legal implications of all this. I'm looking at the political impact. And again, what surprises me when I was going through the article, which is a long, you sit down and you just like untie your tie and you just start. It's not only the myth of the self-made man, but also we kind of knew this, but we need to be reminded this, that in the 80s, in the 90s, constantly his business was falling apart and he was propped up by his father. So the president has been using constantly the image of being such a business genius and a man who can manage finances so well. It proves that it's not the case. And to go back to your question about the fraud in there, it's not only that his father was there all along, but they have really been against it looks, if this is well-founded, he is the president of the United States, but we're reading decades of tax dodging and ways to avoid supporting the state he represents now, which is kind of fascinating.
It is fascinating, and it's a good point. This reminds us that his entire financial backing, his empire, has always been entangled in dubious deals. There, you know, all sorts of rumors of foreign money that also propped him up. And it reminds us that he is the only presidential candidate in modern history to refuse to release his tax returns. And
which he promised repeatedly that he would do, and he still has never done.
Has never done.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it right there. Let's take a quick break. More Issues in the News in just a minute.
Issues in the News is coming to you from Washington on the Voice of America. A reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And while you're there, don't forget to check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. You may also visit, listen, and like us on our Facebook page, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Richard Lutton-Dress, Washington correspondent for TV8 Nouvelle. Our moderator is Paul Brandes of West Wing Reports and USA Today.
Welcome back. The United States and Canada have struck a deal to revise the North American Free Trade Agreement. It allows for Canada to join a trade pact that was hammered out in August between the U.S. and Mexico. Now, Richard, you're a Canadian. You've been covering this for a very long time. Give our listeners sort of the highlights of this apparent deal.
Well, from the Canadian perspective, if I can use a very efficient word, is phew. Which is actually, we thought it was going to be more painful than this. I'll get back to the reaction of the dairy industry in Canada, which is pretty negative. But overall, the president wanted to get rid of NAFTA, not only of the deal, but of the name too. So we have a new name, USMCA, the agreement. The interesting aspect is that more cars will be made in North America using higher wage labor, which is interesting. 3/4 instead of 2/3 of the car parts will also have to come from North America. There's an important notion of we bring back work in the U.S., and the president insisted very much on this. I believe, is it a good or a bad deal? We have a deal. From the Canadian perspective, we fear that the tone the president had, the way things were going, at a certain moment we thought that he was kind of ready to see the entire structure crumble just to satisfy his appetite to punish Canada or to get something done. So we have this deal, which is actually interesting because it touches different aspects, financial services, digital businesses, the dairy industry. Let's just talk about this point because the president constantly, and from our perspective, we were like, when he was saying like Canada is abusing our farmers with 300% tariffs on milk. In the end, we opened Canada's dairy market 3.6%, which corresponds to what we gave the Europeans and in the new Trans-Pacific deal. I mean, it's kind of painful. We have a way to supply management to make sure that our dairy producers will stay and work in the country. But it's a small concession to keep this agreement, which is in the end good for North America.
Well, here's a quote here from the Wall Street Journal, which is not exactly a protectionist kind of. They're big pro free traders. And here's their quote. And Tracy, react to this if you could. They say the new NAFTA, and they continue to call it the new NAFTA, is worse for trade and worse for economic growth than the status quo. So they don't like this. They call it worse.
Well, that's interesting. I think one thing that interests me is this, you know, the minimum wage on the auto workers. That is going, I don't see how Mexico is going to do that. That would be a huge increase in wages there. I'm not sure why it's worse. I don't really agree that it's worse. I think it's not a bad deal. I think that it's not that different from what existed. President Trump is trying to portray this as a completely new, unique deal. Thanks to him, he tore up NAFTA. Now we've got something new. And in fact, this is a modernized NAFTA that, you know, is what everyone wanted to begin with, except for Trump. And it pulled in several features of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, which Trump tore up and walked away from, and now it's been incorporated into this treaty. So I don't see it as such a bad deal. I know Canada desperately wanted something, and Mexico very desperately wanted something. And they were able to finally come to agreement in between the time they had held presidential elections and before the new government came in. So timing was key for them. But I think that, you know, overall, how could you have a regional trade agreement without Canada? Mm-hmm. So I think in the end, I don't think it's such a bad deal.
And I also think, Paul, that the damage is minimal. The opinion of the Wall Street Journal is interesting because as much as we can imagine some other ways to improve the agreement, in the end, the commercial relations between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico will keep on being intense. And this agreement doesn't look, from the Canadian perspective, as impairing this relationship. It's going to keep on growing.
The other thing to point out here is that Trump calls this a victory, suggesting it's a done deal, but it's not a done deal. This still has to be approved by Congress. It won't even be submitted. And here's the interesting part. It won't even be submitted till later this year. In other words, after these November elections, when everything could change. And it's uncertain if the Democrats were to take over Congress, how they might react to this. So for the president to say, oh, this is a big victory, that's kind of premature, isn't it?
It is premature. What else is new? I think one thing that maybe some conservatives don't like is that this deal did retain some of the adjudication procedures that Canada really wanted when there are trade disputes, and that the Trump administration tends to not want to have to be, you know, have to obey any kind of international adjudication. So that may be what some conservatives oppose. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Democrats say about this after the elections.
Because it's interesting when you kind of get into, you were talking about autos, big American labor unions do not seem displeased with this. They haven't fully endorsed it, but they say, look, there are things in here that we like. That's a big deal. So even if the Democrats were to take over Congress, boy, it's hard to see how much they could oppose this if the big labor unions are behind it. So it could be a quandary for these Democrats.
Maybe. Right. Labor unions, farmers, mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of people in sectors, segments of the voting base that really, you know, do like it or at least seem to approve of it. So, yeah, it would be politically difficult for anyone to oppose it too strongly.
And it very well could be, and this is for you, Richard, you know, President Trump has always said that every deal was bad. NAFTA was bad. Trans-Pacific Partnership was bad. Paris Climate Accord was bad. The Iran nuclear deal was bad. And he spent the first year kind of, you know, pulling out of all these, walking away from them. But now in the past couple of months, you know, the deal with Mexico, this apparent deal with Canada, is he starting to get things done? And is he the sort of the deal maker that he always claimed he would be after a year and a half?
He probably will use this if he runs again in 2020. My fear, however, Paul, is that on paper, he ends up with a new deal, an agreement that looks better for him. But in the meantime, the way he manages these negotiations, the tone he has towards Canada, the prime minister, not only, you know, you can say the deal itself was one of the worst negotiated deal in the history of mankind. Then he's talking about Americans, he's talking about another time. But at the center of his attitude now is the way he treats the other leaders, the way he treats the Canadian foreign minister saying she hates America, which is a totally crazy thing to say. I'm not afraid to say this because it's not true. I mean, Canadians love the United States. We're like not even cousins. We're closer to brothers and sisters than cousins. And so to hear this tone and to think that this will help us in, you know, continuing negotiating other things than commercial deals, it's not good.
It's so unnecessary.
So unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine it won't have an impact. One day the U.S. are going to need somebody else somewhere else, and they're going to say, do you remember when you said I was just a beep and then a bap? Well, okay, well, deal with your misery now.
Try bullying someone one day and asking them for a favor the next.
Right.
I think that's what we're...
And trust among many world leaders is really evaporating, trust in this administration.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. We're running out of time here, but I did want to get to one final story here. The United States has canceled what has been called a relatively obscure but decades-old economic pact with Iran. And the reason the U.S. is doing that is because of something the United Nations did. Tracy, what's this all about?
Well, I think at the core of it, it's about just walking away from every kind of international organization you can and bashing Iran at the same time. But what happened was the United Nations, the World Court, ruled that U.S. sanctions against Iran were in violation of that agreement, were illegal because they were hurting the people. And the court ordered the United States to ease its sanctions. And the United States said no and used that opportunity, that ruling, to withdraw from the agreement that they were accused of breaking, which is one way, I guess, to deal with it. But I see this really in the broader picture as another way to bash on Iran, which is what has become really the daily drumbeat from this White House. You saw it at the UN General Assembly, and where last year North Korea was the bad guy, this year it was Iran. So I think that's what this is very much a part of.
What do you think President Trump's endgame on Iran is, Richard?
I think the president has showed that he wants to be close to Saudi Arabia. He wants to be perceived as a solid and unshakable ally to Israel and Iran because of its attitude in the Middle East, and we know that Iran wants to expand its influence in the region. He chose this camp instead of the other one. There's an obsession with Iran in this administration, not a good one, and John Bolton, the National Security Advisor to the President, is probably the most intense anti-Iran guy we can meet in this White House. And again, this week he came out, and in the briefing room we asked him, don't you think by this attitude, the way you do these things, you're closing doors to, you know, potential new talks, new discussions and something else going further? And he said, well, these doors should never have been opened. It's a tough way to imagine how you're going to improve. I mean, Iran remains the economy and the currency are suffering from the sanctions that are coming on November 4th, already suffering from these sanctions. But the reality is that it remains an influential country in the region. My fear is that it's just going to hurt the American perspective in the region for years to come.
Now, Tracy, in our last minute here, Richard just reminded me of something, the so-called P5 plus one agreement with Iran. Trump got out, but the other five parties, two, the British, the French, the Germans, the Russians, and China, all say that they're sticking by it. So the U.S. is really the outlier here. And they seem intent on kind of, you know, waiting the Trump administration out. They continue to want to deal with Iran. President Trump is the only guy walking away.
Yes, this was another instance of America first being America alone. And that deal, the Iran nuclear deal, was also ratified by the Security Council. So the United States, by walking out of it, is violating a Security Council resolution, which is unheard of that a member of the Security Council do that, and then try to punish the other members of the Security Council who continue to try to preserve the deal. The Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese are trying to find ways that countries can continue to import oil from Iran and deal with Iran on a business front without being punished by the United States. And it's going to be very tricky.
All right. We'll have to end it right there. Thanks to Tracy Wilkinson. She's with the Los Angeles Times. And Richard Latendresse, he's with Canada's TVA Nouvelle. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer, Joe Gill. And I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thanks for joining us.